All right, well, I'm going to take a seat now and turn it over to Howard here.
Okay, well, thanks.
New expert.
Well, before I get started, I'd really like to hear if anybody, it's all voluntary, of course, what brought you to this workshop, and what do you think, or what have you heard about this expression, living well, not living better? What do you think that means if you haven't really heard about it before?
I don't remember what it is called, but I have read the statement that Morales or somebody in his group put together, and this was some time ago, and I remember reading it and thinking, you know, where is this happening in the United States? Because this is very exciting. My sense of what it is, what is it? It stops, well, first of all, it would unseat the notion that private property is king, and it would bring things back into balance between the planet and the life forms on the planet. I don't know where humans got the idea that they are necessarily the wisest either. Yeah, we talk about age, but humans have this notion. That's my sense of it.
Great. Well, thank you. Anybody else want to take a stab? There's no wrong answers here.
I will take a stab, actually. I hadn't heard this before, but, you know, based off of breaking up the linguistics of it, I imagine living well, not living better. It just creates a new standard of what is a satisfactory life. And I think it's the idea of, I imagine, based on that title, that it's about being grateful for what you have and getting to a point, again, where everyone is provided for, but not about constantly striving for more and more and more. So that's how you will tell me if that is at all what that's about, but that is, based on the title, what I would imagine is.
Those are all part of it.
Cool. It's about much bigger than
what
that.
Both of you said are definitely all part of the what it means. Anybody else? Yes, Rebecca.
Just kind of following off of what Sarah said, that it's not necessarily about more and more and more. It reminded me of a Lutheran workshop that I attended. The theme was enough. Mm-hmm. That there is enough.
Right. So this is a concept that really is part of all indigenous societies all over the world, but it's really been raised recently by those indigenous peoples and nations in Latin America. Like I said, at the World's People's Climate Conference, I don't know how many of you kept up with that, but if you didn't at that point know about it, you could find the website if you just put in 2010 Cochabamba World People's Climate Change Conference. It's on there. Also, if you go to Democracy Now!, for those of you who look at Democracy Now! Or want to look at it, Amy Goodman was there the whole week, and there are many good reports, including one of the most, I would say, direct interviews she's ever done, and that was with Eva Morales at the end of the week. Probably that is second to her phone call with the President of the United States. I don't know how many people heard that conversation with Clinton, but if you haven't, you want to definitely check that out when he was president. So there were 30,000 people who showed up. This concept really is a translation, and you can't, of course, like anything else in indigenous cultures, very easily translate this into a Western mindset. But it's a translation of a Quechua phrase that's called Kumat Sawat. And there's many components to it. And if people are interested, I can give you my card when we're finished. And I can send you the most extensive document in English that I have, which is about 14 pages long. And it's a really good document because it quotes and translates several different people, organizations, governments, which include Ecuador and Bolivia, who've incorporated this concept, actually written into their constitutions over the last decade. Whether it's being practiced or not is a controversial area that we'll talk a little bit about, but the concept has been popularized. And so this is a concept that comes, like I said, from many indigenous cultures, and I think comes from a lot of our culture, even though it's being buried by the kind of society that dominates us. And this is again, a thousands of year old expression in Zapotec that's translated. Zapotec Indians are the major indigenous force in the state of Oaxaca. Oaxaca is important for many reasons. It's a genetic home of corn. It's also the place that Benito Juarez was born. In August of last year, there was a major meeting when the Pope went to Bolivia. And who do you think said this? The Pope, Evo Morales, or both of them?
Imagine both, maybe, hopefully.
Laudato Si, maybe?
Mm-hmm. Anybody else? Well, actually, this is what Evo Morales presented at the 2009 Copenhagen COP15. COP is Conference of Parties. That's the United Nations conference you've probably heard of. The last one was COP21 in Paris. But certainly the Pope could have said this, and this is certainly contained in many parts of Laudato Si. So there is a certain meeting of minds between the two of them, not just exchange of gifts. I think everybody here is old enough that some people remember who Barry Commoner was. Raise your hands.
Proudly.
Okay. Want to tell us who he was?
Yeah, I remember he ran for president.
He did. In 1980, he ran for president.
All of it in a package. And if.
Good memory.
That's what I would have said as well.
So, along with Rachel Carson, Barry Commoner were the two most important American ecologists in our, well, at least in the 20th century. Barry Commoner is responsible, probably more than any one individual, for the nuclear ban treaty. He was invited to the White House in 1961, right after Kennedy got elected. He is someone who has been buried in recent history since he ran for president. And for sure buried by all the big green organizations, Greenpeace, Sierra Club, National Resource Defense Council, environmental groups that are national. They don't want to talk about Barry Commoner because he was a socialist. He was an activist, probably more than almost any scientist in the 20th century. He combined organizing activism with science. He, more than any person, is responsible for the cleanup of the Great Lakes. We're all old enough to remember the PVCs that were in the Great Lakes and many other chemicals. Not that the Great Lakes are pure by any means, but he was responsible for that. He discovered that strontium-90 was expressed in breast milk, and that's what started a worldwide campaign that led to the nuclear ban treaty. But the most important thing is that his four laws of ecology, which are not something that just came out of Barry Commoner's head, are actually, but the way he put them together are very important, is very consistent with the concept of living well and not living better. As you saw, Evo Morales, who took his words from his own people, I think everybody here knows he's the first indigenous president of Bolivia, and one of the few, along with Benito Juarez, to ever be elected anywhere. This concept of everything is connected. So one of the things in Western rational thought is like we feel like, okay, I can go buy this iPhone and that's all that there is. You know, I don't think about people jumping off the roof in China, committing suicide, who make the iPhones. I don't think about any of those things. I don't think about where the material comes from. I don't think about what happens when I trade it in for the next model of iPhone. So the first day in class in 1965, when I was one of many of the students at Washington University, I was very fortunate that was the height of his career. He literally, the first thing he did was pull out, it was very rare then, an aluminum can of either Coke or something else. There were very few aluminum cans. What was Coke in those days? And milk?
And bottles.
And what did all of us do?
Recycle.
No, we didn't recycle them.
Well, we turned them back in.
We returned them. And then what happened to them?
They were refilled.
They were washed and refilled, right?
Yeah.
Very different than recycling. Actually, recycling glass is one of the worst environmental things that can happen because you have to crush up the glass and it goes back to silica, and then trying to reconstruct it uses enormous amounts of energy, which result in enormous amounts of emissions and results in workers getting silicosis. which is almost as bad as pneumoconiosis, which is black lung disease. Sometimes it's worse. So what he said was, I want to know, well, first of all, why are we making these cans? Who's benefiting from them? Who's being hurt by them? And what's coming out of the earth, and how is it destroying the earth? So that was the first thing he said in the first class I took from him 51 years ago. Everything must go somewhere. So I think we're all aware that on the first Earth Day, those five of us who are this age, but you may have seen this, there was an upside-down triangle. Okay, and by far the biggest thing was what? The three R's. Reduce. Then the next biggest thing was reuse, and the smallest thing was recycle. Well, the first two words are out of the English language the last 30 years. Nature knows best. He did communicate with Rachel Carson. I don't think they ever did a project together. But they did talk with each other, of course, and they were in line, of course, in this concept that we can't outdo nature. And trying to invent technology to outdo nature is most of the time a lost cause. And this is very important because the solutions to climate change that are being put forward and that were codified in the agreement in Paris, which is not a treaty, it's just an agreement, depend a lot on techno fixes and doing all kinds of things, including putting particles in the air and things like that. And there's no such thing as a free lunch. So everything has consequences, no matter what. There's Barry at Exxon's Alaska, when the first oil spill happened. He was there, of course. We're not going to show this, but this is the same thing that Evo said. It's just it was a Democracy Now! Interview. You can find this very easily on the website. So the country of Bolivia codified this into 10 elements, which are all part of their constitution. We're just going to go through them. Nothing here that I don't think surprises you. Now, water as a human right is very important because the greatest victory anywhere in the world against water privatization was in Cochabamba in the year 2000. This event, kind of by coincidence, it wasn't planned this way, it just happened, was at the same time as the 10th anniversary of the Cochabamba Water Wars. If you haven't had a chance to find out about that, I would highly recommend a film. It's one of the best films, not just on the environment, called Flow. Has anybody seen that film? Yeah. So you should be able to get it at your library. It used to be on Netflix, but last night somebody said it wasn't there anymore, but it's, you know, you can find it. You don't have to pay for it. But it's a great film, and it's one of the few films that talks about a worldwide struggle and shows the United States what's happening here. So it's not just about the poor people in developing countries. Number two is very important in the sense of that there are certain public things that should remain public and never be privatized. We're going to talk about that a little more. Consumerism, of course, and promote diversity. Is a really key thing. There are many different indigenous nations within Bolivia. By percentage, it's the largest indigenous nation in the Western Hemisphere. By population, Mexico is the largest indigenous nation, but by percentage, Bolivia is about 2/3 to 3/4 of the population. Okay, this is kind of a expanded upside down the triangle that's part of the zero waste movement, which exists in the United States as well as the rest of the world. One of the best things that happened in Paris, of course, that was nothing good happened inside the COP. These were things outside that I was privileged to be part of, was there was a two-day conference on zero waste. We're probably going to talk a little bit about zero waste, but the idea is very similar to the first Earth Day. And the first thing is, don't even make it in the first place, because most of it's not necessary. And I think the rest of it's self-explanatory. If you're interested, I'll be happy to send you my PowerPoint. You can use it wherever you want. I don't have a copyright. Okay, let's talk about good news and then try to talk about next systems. And I think what several of us said at the beginning is really key here. There are micro things that exist in the United States. Actually, there's a couple of macro things, which I'm going to talk about. I'll mention here, but I'm going to talk about in the next workshop on the public sector. So we're gonna see a little movie in a minute, but the five of us are old enough to remember when public transit was probably 3 or 4 times more, you know, in terms of volume and frequency and all those things. You know, I really tried to figure out how I could get here without driving my car. So first I was going to take a bus, and you may have heard that 5 days ago, what's the name of that, Megabus? Yeah, a Megabus burned up in Lake Forest outside Chicago that it was on its way to Milwaukee and Madison. So I decided not to take the bus. Then I tried to figure out how to take the Amtrak from Chicago to Milwaukee and then take the bus from Milwaukee to Madison, but that took 7 hours, and I wasn't able to do that, so I ended up driving. But of course, 70 years ago, I could have taken the train from downtown Chicago to downtown Madison. So the good news is public transit is up 20% in the last 20 years, the highest ridership in over 50 years. There's Madison on your right. I know most people here aren't so happy about your public transit system, so everybody's got to work together here with the workers. And this is the really key thing. Nothing's going to get done here if we who are consumers of whatever, particularly public services, don't work directly with the workers who are providing those public services. I was a public servant until 2 months ago when I retired for the third and final time. first from Cook County Hospital, then from the University of Illinois, and last I was the chief medical officer of Will County, which is just outside Chicago. So I'm a big believer that, you know, if the people who use the service work together with the workers and the unions, that we can make great progress. And some of that has happened, right? I think all of you are familiar with the Chicago teacher strike. It wasn't completely successful, but it was partially successful because they have a big community coalition that actually they helped start. Here in Madison, despite people being discouraged, I would say that 2011 was one of the highlights of my life. I spent about 2 or 3 weeks up here. I think there were a lot of good things done then, even though most people aren't happy with the outcome. I think it's a great thing to build on. So the other good thing is on the left is St. Louis. And there in the bottom is one of the future keys to living better. I mean living well, not living better, and that is electric buses. there are now 500 electric buses on order in factories that are in the United States. There are about 75 on the street, including 2, soon to be 4 in Chicago. I don't know if you have one here in Madison. The cost has come down in half in the last 5 years. These buses, two-thirds of the parts are actually built in the United States, and they're assembled in the United States. So this is a huge thing we're going to talk about again in the public sector, but we can start here. One of the ideas of living well, not living better, is that all the environmental groups, including environmental justice groups, I helped start the largest Latino one in the Midwest called Little Village Environmental Justice Organization. With a lot of other people, we shut down the 2 coal power plants in Chicago. But no one talks about the fact that, do we think public transit's a good idea? Yes. So that could be a train, that could be a bus. Do we think bicycles are good? Yes, we do. How about solar panels? Anybody object to that? Wind turbines? Okay, where are those things being made? So your state is the last place 12 years ago that a bicycle was made in the United States, right? And then Trek outsourced everything. Okay, the only buses made in the United States until this are school buses for the last 30 or 40 years. All locomotives in the world almost were made outside Chicago until the end of World War II, except in the Soviet Union. So most of that has disappeared. So when we think about the next system, we cannot think like white upper middle class academics or educated people that we are in this room. We also have to think of our fathers, our mothers, and anybody else who worked in industry, okay? We have to think of how these things are going to be built in the most environmentally and worker-friendly way. Because I'm an occupational health physician as well as a family physician, and what people don't think about most time in the environmental movement is the fact that somebody is building whatever we're using. And most of the time, they're building it and getting exposed more directly than any of us in the community. So we have to think of how we're going to do this. There's been a lot of conversations with the UAW, United Steelworkers. They formed a Blue-Green Alliance over a decade ago. Has a lot of good ideas. Hasn't done much. Okay, so we got to go back and hit them up. I've been trying to get the UAW off their butt for 15 to 20 years because the UAW organized the first assembly line in the world. Anybody know where the first assembly line in the world was?
Flint, Michigan.
Flint, Michigan. Good guess. So Henry Ford went to Chicago in 1891 and lived across the street from the Schwinn bicycle factory. That was the first industrial assembly line in the world. And he lived there, and he went there every day, and then he decided to build his assembly line. So we all know in World War II that in a matter of weeks, everything was shifted from making cars to making tanks and airplanes. So this can be done. This is in our history. Okay, this is not magic. What we have to do is build a mass movement and do everything, I think, that Naomi Klein describes about blockadia, everything else it takes to get this kind of stuff done. It's possible to do, and it's beginning to happen. Okay, other good news. More people are riding bikes. Even though they're not made in the United States, hopefully that'll happen soon. And the millennials are taking the lead. Less people are buying cars in their age bracket. It's gone up a little bit since 2011, but not much. But to ride a bike, for most people to get on a bike, they're going to have to feel safe. And so now we're beginning to move in the right direction with what are called PBLs, protected bike lanes. Okay, now in the US, we have a different definition than in Europe. So the origin of protected bike lanes are in two cities, Copenhagen and Amsterdam. They've been there for decades. They are not putting a stripe down the street. They are not putting a stripe down the street in nylon pylons. That is not a protected bike lane anywhere in the world except the United States. They are something like this, although this isn't the best example. This is on Clyburn Avenue in Chicago, and at least there's a curb that separates the traffic. So there has to be a real physical barrier that it would take a car a little bit of energy to get over. Okay, so the question is, if you had to pick one thing that has changed our lives in the 20th century, I would pick the car. Not just the car itself, but everything that it created, which we can certainly talk about. But a lot of people don't necessarily, particularly your generation, don't necessarily, well, how did this happen? Was it just the Americans decided they wanted to drive cars? So we're going to look at this little, you know how to work this? We're going to look at a little clip here. I'll probably have to sit here. From a fantastic movie, you can see free online. It's called Taken for a Ride. It's one of the best titles and one of the best documentaries I've seen. It's on YouTube, the whole thing's free. A PBS show. So we're gonna stop it right there. And I wanted to know if anybody knows this story.
You mean knows this film?
In what way?
What happened? There were two major events that occurred of how the U.S. auto industry, led by General Motors, literally reshaped America, meaning that destroyed the quality of life in cities and created, you know, urban sprawl, highways, etc. There were two major events, which are both documented in this film. And this was not just a physical event. This was a major emotional event in terms of how we live together, you know, as people, how we socialize, what we do as, you know, that combats individualism. Does anybody know the first major event? It was in the 1930s. I'll give you a hint.
Are you talking about when the oil companies or the auto companies were together, they bought up all the streetcars and
yep.
they tore the rails out?
Yep.
And they left them rusting, you know, and people suddenly had to have a car. They couldn't get anywhere.
Right. So basically, in the United States, by the beginning of the Depression, there were, how many miles? 40 or 50,000 miles of streetcar tracks in the United States. Every city, including your city, including Madison, I have a picture here, had streetcars. And streetcars were great. Not the original ones necessarily with with the horses, but the electric streetcars were great. Here we go. And they were cheap. Some were public and some were private. And so what happened was is that General Motors was very frustrated by this, as well as Chrysler and Ford, but General Motors really took the lead in this with Firestone and with somebody who you may have heard of called Rockefeller and Standard Oil, particularly in California, but even here in Indiana, Midwest. And they decided that the best thing to do, and this was a very well thought out plan, was to literally invent a company that was a front company. This is all documented in here. This guy spent 20 years doing this research in the Library of Congress and basically got all the documents. And so what they did is they invented a front company. The front company went around and one by one bought off all the streetcars in 90% of the cities, ripped them up. They didn't take the rails out, by the way. In most cases, the rails are still underneath the pavement, including, from what I understand, right here in the Capitol. So they just paved over the rails. So then they got these, they bought the biggest bus company in the United States named Omnibus, which were terrible buses in the sense of they were really polluting, terrible stuff came out of them, whatever. People didn't like those buses because of that. They were much, you know, they were used to clean streetcars. And they did this to push cars successfully. So that was the first major event. It was a complete success. Only San Francisco was left with streetcars. Maybe one other place had a couple miles of streetcars. So that was the first success. And the next big thing happened when somebody you probably heard of became president of the United States, who was a general who rolled in a tank into Germany in 1944 and saw what? What did he see?
The Autobahn.
The Autobahn, exactly. And when Dwight D. Eisenhower became president, it was obviously at the height of the the Cold War, and he said, I mean, he was thinking about this the whole 8 years in between, and he said, we have to create a national defense highway system. So the interstate highway system was not originally the interstate highway system, it was the NDHS, the National Defense Highway System. It was to be built specifically so there would be no highway within 60 to 80 miles of any major city, including Madison, Milwaukee. Because there were ICBMs that are going to be going around on these highways inside these big trucks, and if the Soviet Union wanted to try to find them and would hit a missile, it would shoot a missile at it and missed, they didn't want to be in an urban area. Mm-hmm. However, two things happened in very close proximity. I don't know how much collusion there was. One was there was this guy named Mayor Richard J. Daley, who got elected in Chicago, became the most powerful mayor within months in the United States, got all the other mayors together, got elected the president of the, what is that called, National Association of Mayors, whatever that is, and went to Washington uninvited, told Eisenhower we're coming to meet you at the White House, and convinced him to have freeways run through cities. This is very important because the two major reasons that he wanted freeways to run through cities became the major reasons for every major city to have freeways run through cities. First was to continue racism, so he to build major physical barriers in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, all these big cities, so that blacks and whites would never come together. And the second reason was to link the downtowns to the airports, in the case of Chicago, O'Hare. So the Dan Ryan, some of you unfortunately, you've been on that. That was the widest expressway in the world when it was opened, and it was because African Americans were not supposed to live west of the Dan Ryan. So that, those are the two major events. We've been playing catch-up ever since. Even though, you know, it's good now that more and more Americans are taking public transit, we're way behind still every other industrial country, but it's getting better. Okay, this is the situation in terms, I'm not going to play this because I'd rather have us spend more time talking, but this is 1937 in downtown Los Angeles. You can see how many people were excited about the latest model of the best electric streetcar in the world. And these are the quotes from this clip, and again, anybody wants my PowerPoint, you can just click on it. And these are quotes from people who were interviewed in this movie in 1995 who were alive in the 30s and 40s and 50s in LA, and this is what they said. We knew the conductor, et cetera, et cetera. And the last one's really important, I think, for living well and not living better. We weren't afraid to talk to people. Go on a subway or bus now in Chicago or anyplace else and see how many people are talking to strangers. Mm-hmm. You know,
How I was just in Seattle and they had a grace period of a couple weeks where you could ride their brand new streetcar for free.
There you go. Wow. Where's this?
Looks like Madison.
It looks like Madison. So what really pissed them off, General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler, was the fact that this was the big deal. This is a very physical thing that has major consequences to our lives. The streetcars were in the middle of the street, and the cars had to occupy the outside lanes. That was a no-go. And so that's, you know, part of the reason they did this. This is something you may have seen about how much space are occupied by people on a bus versus cars. And this is from 2010. This is no surprise about what Americans would like to do, but can't. Okay, and now we're going to talk about this, and we'll have a few other things quickly I want to go through. But this is the real key. This is the big elephant in the room. How many people think we can solve climate change if we snapped our fingers and just went to renewables? Raise your hand. Okay. So here's another question. What happened in Germany 3 years ago, it's almost 5 years ago, when a major mass movement got the government to shut down all the nuclear plants? And I'm sure all of you know that 30 to 35% of all German electricity is generated by renewables, primarily decentralized solar panels. What happened after that? Well, what happened after that is that the Cheney curve, and if you want to know, we can talk about that, the Cheney curve went into effect. Germans kept consuming more and more energy, and so now they've reopened the largest coal mine on the European continent 3 years ago that is mining the dirtiest coal in the Eastern Hemisphere at record amounts. There was a major Occupy event that happened last year where people actually stopped the mine for a day. But that's why this is really important. Did anybody ever hear of Mr. Jevons? Do you want to tell us what you remember about him?
Well, I'm not very good with this kind of stuff, but my sense is that if you invent technology that uses less energy, you can't guarantee that people simply won't use more.
Thank you. That's perfect. So Jevons was an economist. He was a super economist in the middle of the 19th century in the United Kingdom, in England, and he actually got a meeting with the Prime Minister after writing a series of papers warning the English government that they were going to run out of coal in not just in Wales, but Wales, Scotland, England, if they kept making steam engines more efficient. So remember, before the steam engine, everything was powered by water, which is actually a way to seriously consider going back to, which people are starting to do in some places. And so the steam engine got more and more efficient, and as it got more and more efficient, there were more and more steam engines who were using more and more, developing more and more electricity for more and more industrializations. And at a certain point, Jevons did his calculations working with mathematicians and said, we're going to run out of coal in these many years, like, I don't know, 10 years. And the English government said, great, then we can expand our colonialism by getting coal from the rest of the world that we control. So this is actually not a good graph because there were two major studies done, 2000, 2005, 2010, by the University of Michigan, University of Minnesota, of Prius drivers, two categories of Prius drivers. One are state cars that were actually owned by Minnesota and Michigan that were Priuses, and two were private drivers. There was over 100 cars in each one, and the consistent thing was is they overdrove the efficiency of the Prius, both in terms of how much gas they used and how much pollution. So in other words, even though the Prius, until the electric cars, were the greenest cars out there, they actually weren't because people overdrove them. Okay, this paradox exists in everything. And so what's happened in our lifetimes, those of us who have gray hair here, is that we have successfully, we meaning the government of the United States and most academics, have literally abolished the word conservation. So if you go on the Department of Energy website right now, if you have a smartphone, or the US EPA website, and you type in energy conversation, conservation, what will pop up is energy efficiency. Those are two very different things. Energy conservation means you shut the lights off. Energy efficiency means you replace the CFLs when you got money with LEDs. Two very different things. Studies have been done in homes when they switch from incandescents to CFLs, where people ended up using as much energy as they did with incandescents because they left the lights on longer. Okay? Studies have been done when people put in furnaces and air conditioners that were highly much more efficient than the old ones, and they turned the temperature up in the winter and turned it down in the summer, so they overcame the efficiency. There are many, most academics believe that Jevons paradox does not exist now, and they have no leg to stand on. Why is this the biggest elephant in the room? Because as long as we think that efficiency is the key question in overcoming climate change, it's like the dog trying to catch its tail when she or he is running in a circle, right? Because we can put up solar panels everywhere, and we have the technology to solarize the world right now if there was the political will. But we're never going to catch up if we're using more and more energy per capita. So the key here is to decrease the energy per capita, not just in the global north, but now in the megacities of the global south. Real quickly, food sovereignty. Who is that gentleman in the right with the green hat? Anybody know John? So John Klinsman was the founder of Family Farm Defenders, whose office is down the street. John Peck, who's giving a workshop someplace in this building, is now the executive director. If you want to understand what food sovereignty is and agroecology, John is the person to talk to, but it's quite simple. It means that people grow food collectively and individually and decide what happens with the food, and it's part of a food system, okay? Food system. So there are real examples, and we could spend the whole rest of the session, which I don't want to do. For example, the farm to school program that started in the last 5 years or so. You grow food on the school property, or farmers 10 miles outside of Madison grow food, and you have a system that you supply the schools with food. This is agroecology. It's much more than a science, and it's been proven. In 2011, the Special Rapporteur of the United Nations did a report. He took all the data that scientists all over the world, working with the largest organization in the world, La Via Campesina, 200 million peasant farmers, basically, and said they are right, that per hectare you can grow more food on small, sustainable farms than you can in industrial agriculture, plus the tremendous difference in pollution and climate change. If you want to understand the real concept of industrial agriculture, La Via Campesina and its partner, Grain, G-R-A-I-N, have the best data in the world. And the calculation now is that last year, industrial agriculture accounts now for 51% of all greenhouse gases in the world, when you add up all the different components, thinking about Barry Commoner's expression. Okay, this is the home of agroecology, Cuba, the world's greatest urban ag program and cooperative program, and this is the model cooperative. If you want to go to Cuba, which you'll be able to travel as a regular tourist in the next couple months, and you want to go see this place, contact me. It started off as 1 hectare, it's up to 12 hectares, that's over 25 acres. They produce more food per hectare than any urban area in the world. They employ 151 people who make basically 3 times more than the average Cuban. U.S. urban agroecology. How much what percentage of vegetables did Victory Gardens produce during World War II? 1/3 of all vegetables that the Americans consumed. 12 million Victory Gardens, 9 million in cities, 3 million in rural areas. This is not, we have to reinvent things, okay? This is urban agroecology. This was the largest urban farm ever in the United States, 14 acres in the middle of Los Angeles. It was destroyed 10 years ago this month.
Because?
It was owned by a private developer who decided to develop it. There was a huge battle that went on for 2 years. There's a great movie called The Farm, I think. It's on Netflix, or you can get it at your library. And this is very important, because the key concept to food sovereignty and agroecology is a concept that's very different than what we practiced, although it's been practiced in the past. And that's called farmer to farmer. This started in Central America, which in English it's peasant to peasant. And the idea is that 95% of all knowledge and training does not come from the Wisconsin State or Illinois State Extension Service. With all due respect, because I think there's good people who work in those extension services, it comes from fellow farmers. Okay? When I was growing up on my grandfather's farm, every spring and fall, the seed exchange man came around. And I'm sure people here have those experiences. So this is very important because the first farmer-to-farmer meeting in the United States happened a year ago. It's been going on in Central America and the rest of the world for 20 years, but it's starting here. And last but not least is 1/3 of all carbon emissions come from leaky buildings. And there's a myth that we have to now go out and spend $100 million on a platinum LEED building. If you want to talk about a scam, LEED is one of the biggest ones. We can talk about that later. But there's been major studies done in the UK and Canada, which are colder than where we're sitting right now. We're retrofitting 90% of old buildings, including residential housing, is much more cost-effective and just as much conservation. Remember that retrofitting buildings, it's primarily conservation, not efficiency. In other words, the biggest problem with buildings is they leak and they don't have enough insulation. That's 3/4 of the problem. Not that everybody needs their furnace replaced, that they need new refrigerators, or they need new windows. That's true in a lot of cases, but that's not where most of the gain comes from. It comes from probably spending a couple thousand bucks in your house. On the right is public housing. In Holland, they now have a method of 10 days, they make them into zero net energy buildings. In 10 days, without the people having to leave their house. they just started this in the last couple years. Hopefully it'll come here. On the left is this huge senior public housing project that is in San Antonio. So we have about 10 or 15 minutes left, and I've done too much of the talking, so. Yes?
As you were talking about the agroecology, I think another really critical point is that the industrialization of food protection production in the United States is very detrimental to our health.
Yes.
It isn't just about, you know, widespread E. coli, you know, and those kinds of scares. The food is far less nutritious. And there isn't nearly enough conversation about the lack of nutrition in this industrialized food production and all, besides the transportation problems and all that. It's literally leading to a weaker population and far higher health costs.
Yep. So the American Academy of Environmental Medicine put out a statement 6 years ago. You can find it online easily, where they documented, for example, there are massive increases in allergies due to GMO. And of course, to this day, the US EPA, run by private corporations, we call it for the last 20 years, the United States Economic Protection Agency, says to this day that, you know, and the FDA, that GMOs cause no health problems in humans.
You're talking about the disjunct where people think, well, I can just do this and buy this little phone and it won't hurt anything. I think there's also not an awareness of how the food that you eat is connected to what it grows in and on. Mm-hmm. So there's no attention to the soil itself. You know, it's just this idea that we can just keep planting and not think about what we're doing to the soil. And I don't understand why we're not teaching this stuff in school.
Well, people are beginning to teach this in school, and there's a wonderful movie series, I don't know if you heard about it, that is called 2008 Is Inequality Making Us Sick. Anybody see that PBS series? It's a 8-part series, each part is half an hour. One of the parts is on Native Americans. So one of the ways we waste our money is there's been hundreds of millions of dollars spent studying Native Americans, Mexican Americans. They must have some gene that's giving them diabetes. So in this film, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, one of the most racist institutions we have, kept very good health records in the 18th and 19th century as it pushed people and killed people into reservations. And so in 1904, in what we use in English, the word is Pima in it's Odama people outside of Tucson, Arizona. 4 people out of 15,000 had diabetes. Now that community has the highest diabetic rate in the world. So in this movie, it shows what happened. Of course, their water supply was cut off by miners and ranchers, then by Phoenix. Then they built the biggest USDA, you know, warehouse there. But now people are going back to relearn things from their elders, and what they're doing is they're growing these gardens in every one of the schools. So in several Native American reservations, they've taken over control from the Bureau of Indian Affairs of their schools. And almost every one of them, whatever reservation it is growing traditional food. And the kids, of course, are eating the food because they're the ones growing it. So it's a great series for everybody.
Not too long ago, people were talking about the internet as being the savior and all of this. We were talking about telecommuting, teleworking. We'd all be working from home. That's not happening. I mean, I bring this up in a lot of different conferences, as some folks in this row know, and I get laughed at. Basically, we're doomed to commute. But one more aspect of this, Google and Amazon are answering all of this by having autonomous vehicles. Will be driving in their cars, controlled by them, and basically, you know, whatever we're doing, our knitting or texting each other while in these vehicles. Now, this is happening. It's not even, if we'd be talking California right now, they'd say, yeah, they're parked outside, because California already has been cleared for autonomous vehicle use, as we know many of our cars already have some of these functions that are standard in autonomous vehicles. Now, I'm wondering how you see, again, either or both of these issues. Are we moving from, you know, can we move to a day where a conference like this, we could just, we can indeed all meet at home, but in which case we would meet at home, or the autonomous vehicles gambit?
Well, I think there's a place for doing, you know, things like webinars or whatever thing like that you want to talk about. But, you know, I was fortunate in 1996, I was standing right next to the oldest humanoid footprints in the world in Tanzania, about 3.25 million years old. And I think we're all sitting here primarily because we have face-to-face contact within 6 feet. We know that hormonally what happens in the brain with that contact, assuming it's positive, and I always tell people, if it wasn't primarily positive, we wouldn't be here. So when students ask this in class, they say, haven't we always been fighting each other? I said, yeah, but the question is, what was primary? Like, what brought us to that right now? So I think the greatest false solutions that every big green organization pushes are electric cars. Because the electric cars do nothing to deal with the fact that since World War II, okay, our population has increased 25%, and land use has increased 250% to 300%, depending on the city. Because the cause of that is what we just, I don't know if you were here when we showed the little thing of taken for a ride. So it doesn't matter what powers the car. It doesn't matter if the car powers itself. It doesn't deal with that fact, okay? It doesn't deal with with the fact that as long as there is highways to be fixed and built, we will never get past the dime with public transportation. Building safer sidewalks, building these protected bike lanes, okay? I just drove up here on one of the worst stretches of interstate I ever saw, you know, recently, from the state line of Illinois, and I'm not proud of, you know, Illinois, the first 30 or 40 miles coming up here on 94. Then I found out last night that your state's gonna tear up the whole thing and add an extra lane. You know, they're trying to figure out how to use money for highways. You know, we have the worst tollway authority in the country in Illinois. They're ripping us off, you know, and then they're just figure out how to make the highways bigger. So we can't get off the dime, you know, with that. So I think that social relationships are the key to the future. We have to either continue them or reestablish them. Again, not saying that nobody should be able to telecommute if they want to. But this idea that people are happy living on their own, you know, the guy who wrote the book about the Chicago heat wave, which was the greatest death killer of any heat wave in the history of the United States, Eric Kleinenberg, who I like as a sociologist, he wrote a book 3 years ago about, you know, one third of adults are living by on their own and they like it. I'm sorry, you know, they may say they like it. I don't think that's the way we should be going. People have a choice to live by themselves. But I don't think that's a healthy thing to do. Both as a physician and as a person who grew up in a big extended family, 10 adults and me, the first 6 years of my life in one three-bedroom apartment. So I really think that I would ask that people really rethink this next system, that it has to be people-oriented. And it's good. We have something called Safe Streets. You probably heard about that. Then there's another group called Complete Streets. You can find this stuff all over. And there are good things about that, that we all have to have safer and complete streets. But the safer and most complete streets are getting cars off of them.
But if you have autonomous vehicles, supposedly bikes could be accommodated in the software.
But how would that deal with the expansion of highways? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what powers the vehicle. Do you realize that cement is the second most carbon-intensive production system in the world? So how would that deal with it?
I understand. I'm giving you the techno solution that is being projected. I just would want your response.
Yeah, I think most techno solutions are false solutions. In other words, right now we have all the technology we need to literally go to taking no carbon out of the ground by 2030.
Sorry, there's quick interruption. Sure. So sorry. In 15 minutes, we're meeting two floors down for our keynote speakers and then lunch. So just, and you can continue the conversation down there at lunch.
So 207, how far is it to Minneapolis? 200 miles? Something like that?
No, 3 hours.
So I would really suggest, if you don't know this person, go to look up John Farrell, J-O-H-N, F-E-R-R-E-L-L. He works among five people and himself, or four people and himself. He has a think tank, and he puts out the best letter on renewables. It's a once-a-week email letter. And 6 years ago, he worked directly with the National Renewable Energy Lab, NREL. It's totally funded by our tax money in this room. It's in Colorado. And he said, if we laid 2 feet of solar panels along on both sides of every interstate highway, we'd have 6 times more energy than we would use by the year 2030. That was 6 years ago. Solar panels have gotten much more efficient, you know, since then. But again, if we don't deal with this idea that we have to decrease our per capita energy, then it's going to be like a dog trying to catch its tail. This was not a concept that was embedded in the American culture until this illegal meeting in 2001. This happened the first 2 months that Cheney was in office. He called these two or three illegal meetings that included Environmental Defense Fund, NRDC, National Resource Defense Fund. I can't remember if anybody else went there. And all these industry people, utilities, whatever. And they then convinced themselves, led by Cheney and his, you know, people, that it was inevitable that per capita energy use was going to go up like this. So that's what everybody thinks. And
That's what they want.
And that's what they want, right.
How much of that is population-based, because we keep growing?
No, per capita, meaning it doesn't matter what the population is. It means per individual, this is how much energy we're going to be using. Yes?
Yeah, you mentioned the human dimension, you know, the hormones going up 6 feet away or something like that. There's also the natural connection. I'm an electrical engineer, so I discovered this some time ago, by chance, but, you know, in my politics. But I understand it because I'm an electrical engineer. We have huge positive ions in the cities. All this electricity, all this electromagnetic, we are loaded, gunked up with positive ions. When we go to flowing water out in the country, we get negative ions and we get rebalanced. So it's not just that we feel good in nature and enjoy nature, it has a positive electrochemical effect on us, because it rebalances us.
Exactly.
So you know, just like, you know, we are, you know, from peace studies, you know, cooperation is far more important than competition. You know, get that straight. And then just the other thing, my personal thing, I hate MSG and aspartame. You know, it was years before I found out that these horrible headaches I was getting because of those things. And, you know, when I was hiking next to a nurse, you know, going up a mountain in Mount Pisgah outside of Eugene, Oregon. But why aren't they labeled? Why aren't they, you know, why isn't there skull and crossbones next to these things, you know, on the label of every product or something? You know, the defense secretary under Bush, just because he was on the board of Searle or something like that, and we approved these things, you know, they're immune. And we no longer warn ourselves about things on labels and stuff like that. They're trying to take off what little information we have every chance they get, it seems.
Well, to answer your last question first, I think you know the reason. you know, no matter who is in the White House, whether it's a Democrat or Republican, the last several decades, the Food and Drug Administration started to fall apart and disintegrate under the president who basically deregulated and privatized the federal government more than all presidents before and after him. Who was that president?
Bill Clinton.
Okay. So what happened in the FDA, I'm a semi-scientist physician, is that the vast majority of scientists over 40 years old left by 1999. Now, what happened specifically was a good thing turned into a very bad thing. So people here probably remember one of the best groups in the last several decades called ACT UP AIDS, which still exists, I think. And they disrupted everywhere in the world to get drugs approved so they could save their lives. That was a good thing because the FDA used to take an average of 7 years to approve any medication. But they did that through real human studies. Under Clinton, based on deregulation and privatization, there was a complete switch so that now the average drug, and this has gone forward through Bush and Obama, the average drug gets approved within a few months. The only studies done are done by the company that manufactures the drug until something happens, which is called an adverse event. Then the FDA starts looking at it, maybe. And so this kind of relates to your question about labeling. You know, all the stuff should be labeled. All the health effects should be on there. You know, GMOs, they should be on there, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And the biggest scam is related to the Flint, you know, genocide of lead and water. And that scam is that there's been major studies done that shows that bottled water is far more unhealthy than water out of the tap in 95% of the cases in the United States. And you know how many people in the FDA actually test bottled water? One half-time person. This is in the movie Flow, which is one of the best movies ever made, about not just water, but about the environment. And to your first point, in the 1980s, we in this room, all of us who paid taxes then, funded some of the best studies that one of the 24 National Institutes of Health ever did, which is called, it's called the National Institute of Mental Health. And they found out that most people with mild to moderate depression, if they go outside and they see green, even in the middle of winter, if they look at evergreen trees or bushes, they get better. Actually, they got as better as they did on any medication. Last year, there was studies that were confirmed all over the world where now we can actually measure the amounts of endorphins, serotonin, and oxytocin, those three hormones in the brain, that if you go and you start seeing green, immediately start decreasing our stress level. And it's good to go to the countryside to do this, but in Chicago you have to go about 50 to 60 miles from downtown to see this. And so that's why we need more green space in cities. And the number one blockade to that are cars and too many parking lots. So this is another reason.
Can I just to kind of reinforce the point that you're making, my husband and I visited Niagara Falls several years ago, not all that long ago, and we were dumb. We didn't know, don't go on a holiday weekend. Never go to Niagara Falls on a holiday weekend because half the world is trying to be there. But on the U.S. side, there are huge parking lots, and I do mean huge. There's one that's owned by the Park Service where it's affordable to park. There are private parking lots because they know about this kind of overflow. And I think we paid like $45 to park for the day because the first lot was full and we ended up in a private parking lot. And you know, it was either that or not see the falls while we were out there. On the Canadian side, there are bus stops and other mass transportation stops, and the parking lots are very small. I mean, there may be other places in the world where you can go and see that kind of contrast, but it is so visible and so obvious there, the terrible use of land on the U.S. side, and the much smarter use of land and use of mass transportation that takes people closer to where they want to go to see the falls, as opposed to having to walk through these huge parking lots.
Thank you very much for that. So if people remember who were here at the beginning, one of Barry Commoner's four laws of ecology is everything is connected. So we're up to about 12.5% of all asphalt and cement in the United States is now in parking lots. This is directly related to the major reason for that, and that is big box development, which has also destroyed local economies. So if you want to deal with several things at the same time, we have to get rid of big box development. I don't mean just stop it. We have to get rid of them, period. And basically, if you talk to anybody here a plumber or know a plumber? So if you talk to any plumber who's been in business for more than 5 years, they'll tell you that their greatest spike in businesses is right after a big box store builds a parking lot, okay? Because I don't know the topography and geology here very well, but I know Chicago very well. So everybody's basement starts flooding within a quarter to a half mile of that parking lot and big box store as soon as the first big rain hits. So there's many different factors about why we need to get rid of things like that. So.
I was struck by your comment about cement because I'm eligible for senior free auditing classes here at UW, and I took one of several global warming classes, and cement is right in the models. You know, it's a major factor. They measure not just carbon dioxide and carbon, but cement is a major part of every, when they present that calculation to you to work with a climate model.
Yeah, of course, the Union of Concerned Scientists has the best, easily understandable information about what's happening with climate change in each state, in each region of the country. I don't agree with all their solutions like fourth generation nuclear, but they have a lot of good stuff. And so for the Midwest, where we all live, I think, here, we're going to have a 33%, they predicted this in 1998, and it's been true, a 33% increase in overall precipitation. So of course, in any area that's got cement or asphalt, it's going to cause a lot of flooding, in addition to everything else you said. Any other points that people would like to make or questions? If people want to stay in touch, I either have cards or you can write down my email address. It's pretty easy. My first initial is H. And then my last name is EHR, M like mother, A like apple, N like never, at UIC, that's University of Illinois at Chicago, .edu. And we are trying to, you know, this is several people and organizations that met up with again in Paris. and from before, we're trying to really get this message out of that if we don't figure out what we call macro conservation solutions about decreasing our energy use, then basically the game's probably over. I mean, maybe we have 15 years at the most until we go to the tipping point, but we could be past the tipping point already. I think everybody here is aware of that. So that's the really key issue to really work on. This is, and I'll just give you one last example. This does not mean that we all have to feel guilty because we don't have the latest LED bulbs in every socket in our house. If you can afford it, great. I haven't changed mine out, and my overall income is much better than most Americans because it's not, I figured it out. So far, it's not worth it. It may be next year or the year after. For example, in California, the individual per capita water use in California has decreased by a third over the last decade. But there's still a huge drought, and there's 10 towns without water since May. They're all under 10,000 people. No water. So what's the reason for that? Well, the reason is because industrial agriculture uses 81% of all the water in California. Mm-hmm. So as long as we keep subsidizing the third wealthiest man in California to continue to plant more almond trees and to perforate down as far as he wants into every aquifer within reach, mm-hmm. then it's not going to help us to just keep individually doing stuff. So we're talking about macro solutions. The next system, which needs to be now, is that all this stuff has to stop. You know, and it's a macro solution, primarily. It's not just what we can do individually. You know? So thanks, everybody, for coming, and I'd love to stay in touch with you.
Let's keep the conversation going. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Yeah, round of applause. I'm not sure. I'm on my mind.